Turn it on. Okay. Oliviana, you got that turned on for me up there? Okay. All right. Oliviana is our helper in the AV booth today. So this morning, it was kind of last minute. I found I was going to be preaching. Dwayne, you know, they went in Alaska and they all were quarantined with the flu. And then many of you might have gotten the message yesterday that also his mother passed away yesterday afternoon. So keep the Spiveys in your prayers today as they are going through that process and traveling and coming together. Definitely could use our encouragement and support as we find out more of her arrangements. So this morning I wanted to, talk about some things we've been going over in our fifth and sixth grade class this summer. And our faith is under attack. We are under attack from various angles. And of course, one of those is by evolutionists who like to teach things that are science that aren't really science. So as part of our combination of fifth and sixth grade, we've been going through a journey from Apologetics Press dealing with Christian evidences. And one of the most rewarding evenings, I mean, it's been a really good time going through that. And now Jake Mastriani is going through that this quarter with them. But we got about to the sixth lesson. And Callie Snyder, she popped up with a question that we had not even talked about dinosaurs yet. But we were going through talking about logic and reason and questions we can ask about these things that were taught that were called science. And she just simply asked, does this mean that dinosaurs and people live together? I mean, it was just amazing to see that. We hadn't even mentioned dinosaurs and humans. And I know we've had Eric Lyons, we've had Kyle Butt, we've had Jeff Miller come speaking to us. And maybe we've covered some of that in some of our summer series. But for her, not even to mention that, and the way we're talking about the Bible, talking about creation, that question just naturally came to her. And of course, in our public schools, we're getting a completely different message. So that's what I want to do this morning is, as I've taken a lot of that material, so if you've been in that class, you're going to get a bit of a review today. But it's so exciting for me to talk about and to share with you, to at least give you just a few points of which you can say, hey, here's some questions we can ask about this. Here's the ways we can think about creation. So no means is this an exhaustive study on apologetics or all the different evidences we can give, because God's creation is so vast, so marvelous, that you can take one little thing and look at the very detail of it and come up with many things. Let's see, I hit the right button here. So in your hearts, honor Christ as the Lord as holy, always being prepared to make a defense to anyone who asks you for a reason for the hope that is in you, yet do it with gentleness and respect. And that's a key right there, is because it's easy to get our emotions all wrapped up into this. It's easy to get all flustered and attacking these atheists, these evolutionists, and become a back and forth in an argument. But that's why I think Paul and Jesus are very clear here. And Peter, throughout all the times that they've been working with people throughout the book of Acts, it's all done with gentleness and respect. Now, Jesus, we look at him and we see that he's the greatest apologist that ever was. He gave evidence for the reason that he was the Son of God. And part of that was that prophets predicted his arrival and timing. Everything about his birth was predicted by the prophets. The miracles he performed, supernatural miracles of raising people from the dead, healing the sick, were all part of giving his own evidence. The death, burial, and resurrection foretold. The book of Isaiah is a very beautiful passage in that. And that he also taught with questions. He taught with questions to get people to think, to get the people who are attacking him to kind of think themselves, and they would stop attacking him. So Jesus is our greatest apologist, our greatest example in everything, and even when we're trying to give a defense. But I want to first kind of talk about a few definition of terms. First, we're going to talk about evolutionists. They believe the universe and life came about by strict natural processes, starting with the Big Bang 13 plus billion years ago and evolving to where we are today. Now, this group includes regular people just going about their daily lives, and it also includes very intelligent scientists, people who are studied a lot smarter than I am. So let's go to this. A creationist, they believe the universe and life was created by the God we read about in the Bible. Now, this group includes regular people. A lot of us are here today just going about our daily lives, and very smart, intelligent scientists. So we've got to dispel this notion that we sometimes are given that creationism or believing that God created things is for ignorant people, and it's not, because there are very smart people, a lot smarter than me, who also believe in the God of the Bible. Now, somewhere in the middle between creationists and evolutionists, they believe that the universe had to be created by a supreme being, but don't give allegiance to a personal God we know in the Bible. And Albert Einstein and many others that are famous, what we call fathers of science, kind of fall into this group. They know that there's no way that this could be happened by accident. The probabilities are too great, but they would just say it's some supreme being, but not really acknowledge that there is a personal God in the Bible. It's also defined science as we talk about this. That's another thing that gets thrown around a lot about is science. And by the definition on Wikipedia, or most that you'll look at, will say the intellectual and practical activity encompassing the systematic study of structure and behavior of the physical and natural world through observation and experiment. Now, that's the key words there, is observations, things that we can see, and experiment. We test it out. We figure it out. So how do we prove there is a God? If your bike was going flat, how do you know it's going flat? Well, it goes flat. You can't ride it anymore. And how do you figure out where that air is coming out? Well, you might put it in some water and observe where those bubbles are coming out. So we use our senses to study the world around us. We have taste, we have sight, hearing, smell, and touch. We use those to study the world around us. And there's actually a scientific method. I mean, this is a process that scientists go through developing all the technology we have, the drugs we have. I mean, everything we do related to science. There's observation, which generates your questions, and you come up with your hypothesis after you do some research. Then you're going to experiment. You're going to collect your data, and you come out with your conclusion. And you can repeat that process over and over and over and over again. And that's how we get where we are today with technology, is a scientific process. Now, there's also another thing that is sometimes discredited by evolutionists is what, if you read a material from Answers in Genesis, you read material from Apologetics Press, you'll hear about historical science. Okay, so that's educated guesses about the past based only on what we can observe in the present. And there's no way to prove how something exactly was in the past. Except if, I'll throw an exception in here, unless we have it recorded. So we know the Eiffel Tower at the World's Fair back in the early 1900s, 1800s. We know about things that were recorded for us in history. And of course, what we know and believe is that the Bible is the Word of God. So we want to know what happened, what was recorded at the beginning. We have the Word of God to give us that picture of what actually happened in the beginning. So that's how we know what's happened in the past. But everything else is a guess in terms of going back, trying to go back millions of years. Evolutionists try to discredit it in this point, but the fact remains we can't know for sure how things were in the past, especially when it comes to how it came to be, how life came about. There's no way to actually prove it. So can we prove the Big Bang or evolution with the scientific process? No, we can't. We can't taste it, we can't see it, we can't hear it, we can't smell it, we can't touch it, we can't recreate that process. And can we prove creation with the scientific process? And you know what? The answer is no. We cannot recreate or scientifically prove that God spoke and everything came. So both of these views require faith. All right? And that's going to be very important as we talk about this. I'll go back to Hebrews chapter 1. Now, faith is the assurance of things hoped for, the conviction of things not seen. So if you're not talking in a biblical sense, you're not talking about the God of the Bible, you can kind of create that for anything. I mean, evolutionists, they are sure, they are hoping that there is no God, that everything came about by an accidental bang from this little tiny molecule that just expanded to the universe as we know it. They're placing their hope and their conviction in that. We place our hope and our conviction in a God who said, "Let there be light," and there was light. So we can defend our faith with logic and reason. And in this defense, I want you to remember this. In this defense, we confess Jesus as Lord of all creation and share his gospel with a lost world. So confessing Jesus is not just what we do. We get up here before we're baptized and say, "Yes, I believe that Jesus is the Son of God." This is part of that lifelong process of confessing Jesus as Lord of all creation. So we can defend it. Now what we're going to do is go through some of these interesting points here that we discussed throughout our summer quarter, just giving you some ideas and points. And I'm sorry if some of this is small or you're trying to write it all down. There's a lot more slides coming up. But we'll post it online. So as this is going to be up there, you can go back through these slides and look through these because there's a lot of information on them. So how excited would you be to find an iPad lying on the ground? I've got one sitting right over there. I imagine some of y'all are maybe reading your Bible off of them. And then especially, you'd be really excited if it had a note on it saying, free iPad for whoever finds this. All right. It just saved me, well, either, you know, $30 a month if you're on a plan, or $600 or $800, or newer ones are probably going to be $1,000 if you decide to buy it out of pocket. So yes, you'd be very excited. Now, then would you believe that that just happened by accident? That everything coming together to create that iPad, all the electronics, the battery charging, the screen display, would you believe that could have actually happened there by accident? I wouldn't. So that's an iPad is one piece of technology. But if we look at just our human eye, and there's so many aspects of our human body that we could go into that you could just open up any science book and just really marvel at the way God created it. But I just want to take the eye for an example. So the human eye requires the equivalent of 3.8 million processors per second for vision. There was a neurologist that was kind of answering this question on Quora, you know, where he kind of asked questions and kind of figured it out. So he tried to figure it up. If you kind of look at how many neurons and how many synapses we have and how much power of the brain it takes to process vision. I mean, and then you think about computers, sometimes the most processing power a computer takes is actually processing the video, you know, the 3D rendering, the things that we see. It takes some of the most power from the computer's processor is actually to create what we see on the screen. So it'd be about 3.8 million processors. So you take most of our computers, most of our iPads, they just have one processor in them. So to achieve that power, humans have filled entire rooms with supercomputers. This is one of them in Japan. And I think since this picture was, there's more. So there's computer rooms, there's supercomputers that have anywhere from 3 million to 5 million processors in them. But you know, it takes that amount of power, that amount of space to achieve the processing power just our eye has with our brain in communicating it and processing that vision. So and that's not even counting the fact that how we then receive that information, how we react to that information, what we do with it, how our emotions process. So you start adding all that all together, and there's no way we could create any kind of processing power feasibly on this earth to compare with what's in our brain, especially what just happens between our brain and our eye. If you look at just something like a hummingbird, I mean, they're beautiful to watch, just floating. You can't even see their wings as they're flapping. And we've tried to create robotic hummingbirds, and they do pretty good. They get around fairly well, but they still can't compete with the perfection, the precision, the energy consumption, the output that the hummingbirds have. We also look at just a design. That design, we're talking about how design demands a designer here, and God's design is everywhere. And what do artists usually do? They'll have a theme. They'll have a mark that they sometimes leave. So maybe sometimes if they're doing different types, they'll just have their signature. But artists leave their mark and theme throughout their work. So if you think about seashells and how they form with this spiral shape. And then you look at something as large as our galaxies. And we have so many of our galaxies we found that are spiral galaxies. And you just think about a God that would create things, a God with so much creativity and art. Of course, he's going to have these themes that kind of weave throughout his creation. It's just something to think about as we look at the world God created. So the law of cause and effect, that every material effect must have an adequate cause. All right? So would a tornado produce a Mercedes? It's going through a junkyard, and then that tornado comes through, and then there's a Mercedes, all right? And then there's a note on there that just says, hey, free to whoever finds this Mercedes. Okay, we'd probably be pretty excited if you want to drive a Mercedes. But that's impossible. That's impossible to happen. So the universe is the effect of an adequate cause, but matter cannot create itself. All right, so that's proven over and over again. As part of our natural laws, we know that we cannot create matter. We know we can't make matter become more than what it is. 1 gram of rock is always going to be 1 gram of rock, no matter what we do to it. Or it'll be some different form of energy or matter, but we cannot get rid of that 1 gram. So what was the cause of the universe and all matter? All right? So energy cannot be created or destroyed. That's the first law of thermodynamics, very kind of simplified form of it. But these are established natural laws. And there's a second law of thermodynamics. There's a law of biogenesis. There's a whole lot of natural laws that whatever caused the universe could not be material. So when you think about the Big Bang and these theories, well, that Big Bang theory itself breaks a natural law. And we watch sometimes these videos. In class, we would watch these evolutionist videos, and they would get really, you know, they were actually geared towards kids. And the purpose of watching them was, after we went through several lessons of how to think through this, was find the things that they're mentioning and find the things where they're leaving big gaps or where you know that this isn't true. And they would just say, well, that Big Bang, that's when the first law of thermodynamics came into existence. And if you take hydrogen and you set that aside for a few billion years, you might end up with life. Okay, so there's a lot of these statements they were making throughout the video that were just, when you think about it, are just utterly and completely ridiculous. But they're wrapped in a package to make kids think like, oh, this is cool. This is fun. This is where life came from. This is how we came to be. So I wanted them to see that, to really be thinking about how they can defend their faith. So that's what's important, is the Big Bang itself violates, I mean, a whole lot of natural laws that science has proven. So the law of cause and effect, the Bible tells us the cause and how energy was created. In Exodus chapter 20, verse 11, for in 6 days the Lord made the heavens and the earth, the sea, and all that is in them. All right, so that is the cause that created it. Bombardier beetle, a bombshell for evolutionists. So now we're going to kind of go through some of these various animals and things and kind of look at the very specific details. So you can do this with a lot of different creatures. So the bombardier beetle, scientists estimate that 40% of insect species are beetles. That's a lot of beetles. And they're crunchy, they're creepy, they crawl, they get everywhere. But what is so special about this beetle? It doesn't have a bomb attached to its back, but it has something very special. It contains two harmless chemicals, one of which is hydrogen peroxide. You get a cut on your arm, on your leg, you're going to get the dirt out, you put some hydrogen peroxide on there. Very harmless. Now, the two chemicals combine with this hydrogen peroxide in a special storage tank, and they spray with a liquid that heats to 212 degrees Fahrenheit. So that little beetle can pack quite a punch. And so then when you kind of look at it even closer, it comes out at a speed of 500 rounds per second. So you take this little beetle, all of this hot liquid coming out at a very fast speed, and that would be technically faster than what most, you know, modern or advanced machine guns can fire if you take it the equivalent of the size of that beetle and what he's spraying out there. So that would be something you don't want to come across or aggravate for sure. So evolutionists say that this is a product of millions of years of evolution. But here are some questions that we can ask about this, and really any living organism. So questions we can ask. Again, this is where it gets kind of small. But there would be a time it didn't have that 212-degree mixture, if we think about evolution. There had been a time it would have never shot anything out of its back. So what would have happened if it had developed a hot mixture without that storage tank? So it brings those two liquids together in a special storage tank and then sprays it out. But what would happen if it did that without that special storage tank? What would have stopped the beetle from blowing out its back end the first time it happened? Or, there's just so many things that would had to be perfectly in place. And the only answer when we come to this perfection that comes in place is that a powerful, creative God who created it to operate correctly the first time. Okay? For every house is built by someone, but he who built all things is God. So all things are created by God. Let's look at some woodpeckers. These are pretty marvelous creatures. I mean, sometimes they sound beautiful in the woods, and I guess if it lives outside your house, you might get a little annoyed by them. But if a person hit their head with the force of a woodpecker does, that person would quickly die. They hit with 1,000 times the force of gravity, which is 250 times more than the force an astronaut feels on liftoff. That is some powerful force for that little beak to make holes and to burrow into the wood. So how does the skull not break and its brain burst out? Well, it has a strong and extra thick skulls, perfectly placed in shock absorbers between the beak and skull. So it's extra thick, it's got shock absorbers, and a perfect beak that does not wear out in 10 years or 10 million pecks against a tree. So we think about that in comparison to maybe if we look at a car, we've got shock absorber systems, things that make us really feel smooth going down the road. We've invented those things to make sure that we don't feel the impact of every little pebble on the road. Well, that's exactly what woodpeckers have developed and were created with. So they drill into trees to find insects to eat. They have a perfectly sticky long tongue, not like other birds, to scoop them out. They carve a home to live. They communicate with other woodpeckers. So that pecking process is a large part about how this woodpecker lives. So you think about that, and you're like, man, this thing does a lot of stuff. What in the world? So this is where it gets really, really small here. You can go out online and look at this here. But these are just, I actually even cut a few questions off of here that you can ask about the wondrous woodpeckers. So why did they even start banging their beaks when they simpler to just gather bugs and fruit on the ground? Why would it evolve just to do that and just do that? How would the first woodpecker not kill itself the first time again beating against a tree? Again, that perfection that has to be there with that system to protect its brain, the skull, the beak, the shock absorbers. How did it know to close its eyes to protect and keep eyes from popping out as it hits that tree? When did it develop the perfect shock absorber between the skull and beak? If the cushion took millions of years, how could it have gathered food? And when and how did the sticky tongue develop to make it possible to gather insects? Why would they peck at wood if they couldn't eat? You know, so they didn't have this tongue. Why would they be pecking at the wood? How did they know to develop two back claws to have a better grasp than normal bird would have? So most birds, you have, you know, three bird feet. Well, it has two on the back and two on the front. It gets a tighter grip on the branch when it's hitting that tree at such force. And who taught them to drill in the tree for shelter? I mean, what in the world? Why would you do that? If it's more efficient to just evolve to where you're getting it more simply from the berries that are on the tree, from the bugs that are on the ground, the easy, that would make more sense. And a Komodo is a bite out of evolution. It can reach 10 feet long and weigh 250 pounds, eat 80 pounds of meat in a few minutes. Now, their mom says, don't brush your teeth, all right? So most of us are moms, and I'll remind my kids, all right, go brush your teeth, all right? But they say don't brush your teeth because those leftovers, okay, grow deadly bacteria that infect the bite victims to kill in a few days, yet doesn't harm the Komodo. Okay, so then the question, you start asking questions. Well, if it had developed the ability to do this bacteria before it had the ability to not have it affect it, well, wouldn't it die? And how did that all come to be in a perfect system for it to do? And the only question is it's created by an all-powerful God. So we now kind of switch gears to the Bible and the age of the earth, talking about that the Bible has been confirmed by science except for what is unseen. No one can prove the unseen. So history, archaeology, time after time again, people have said, well, these people didn't exist in the Bible, but there's been more and more discoveries that we find the Hittite people. We find evidence of various things. And the Bible uses day as we know, you know, as we know any ordinary day. When it says 6 days of creation, that is six literal days in the Bible, and the Hebrew language proves so. And what does the Bible say? Well, typically, you know, we see this picture as God creating Adam, and that's the picture that gets, you know, from the Sistine Chapel. It's kind of in everybody's mind about creation sometimes, but I think it's a little cheesy. I really don't think that this is that how it would be. If I was to try to get a picture of it, one I found was more like this. Where God said he fashioned from the ground Adam and he breathed in him the breath of life. And we know that Jesus was the Word. Jesus' Word is what created everything. And a more personal forming him out of the ground and breathing him the breath of life. So we think about how the Bible actually describes it and we can get a really good picture of how awesome this really is. Now, if evolutionists are correct, the earth was here billions of years before humans. But Jesus disagreed. He said, from the beginning of the creation, God made them male and female, which means that Adam and Eve were created near the very beginning of creation. Matthew's wording of Jesus' comment is that God made the first human beings at the beginning. And we know on the sixth day. Jesus also said that the blood of righteous people has been shed from the foundation of the world. But what righteous person was on earth near the beginning of the world that was killed? Well, Jesus named Abel, the son of Adam and Eve. Paul agreed with Jesus in Romans 1:20. He said, human beings have clearly seen and understood who God is since the creation of the world. So Paul had been quoting the Greek poets. He's been dealing with them and going through their things, going through their palaces. And you know what? Everything is clearly seen and understood based on what we see in creation. Now, so let's think about from a mathematics perspective here of creation and evolution. So we start thinking about, okay, millions and billions of years. There's these trees out west, the bristlecone pine trees, and they're the oldest living tree. Now, it's the oldest is 5,000 years, and we just know that based on its hardiness, based on the fact that it survives in very desolate places, that it could probably live even longer than this. Now, if evolution is true, why can't we find anyone older? So we've been through, I mean, we've pretty much found all these trees. They're very rare, very, very sparse. But we've not found one that's older than 5,000 years. So what is the best logical explanation for the oldest being 5,000 years old? Well, that would have been about the time of Noah's flood, when every living thing was wiped from the face of the earth. And of course, then those seeds could have been preserved through the water. Seeds can last for a long time. And then after the flood, they would have started growing. Now we go, also the math doesn't add up with the Mississippi Delta. It's approximately 300 million cubic yards of sediment in the Gulf of Mexico each year. I mean, it's just dumping sediment. It's just bringing it down from everywhere north and just dumping it. You can see it right there, that light-colored kind of sandy part kind of sticking out into the Gulf of Mexico. So if you think about that, 300 million cubic yards of sediment, then you kind of multiply that by 5,000, by not 5,000 years, millions, or maybe millions of years that they've said it's taken these continents to drift. If evolution is true without a global flood, about 5,000 years ago, the Gulf of Mexico would have been filled in a long time ago. So you add up that much sediment getting dumped into the Gulf of Mexico, and it would start filling it up. It wouldn't be what it should be today. There's also the story of man's origin, and this is where things really get interesting from the evolutionists. Man was more special than all the creatures created on day six. Now, in our image is the key. God said, let us make man in our image. Jesus said from the beginning of creation, God made them. So let's look at some evidence that evolutionists have tried to use to prove the evolution of man. This is where it gets really interesting, but they really have to. All right, so right there on the top right, you have a picture of Ida in 2009. And the evolutionists claim to be the first link to all humans. But later, you know what? Through science, actual DNA testing and things that we learn through actual observable science, proved to be a lemur, not human. Okay, so they were somehow going to wrap that thing in and say it was an ancient human ancestor. Not true. Lucy in 1974, they quickly rose to fame as a transitional creature, but it proved to be a male ape related to more of the modern chimp. Okay, so they come up with these really nice names and, oh, here's Lucy, here's Ida, to make us really kind of personalize with them and connect. This is our ancestor. Artie in 2001, thought to be a link by evolutionists, later called into question, and DNA helps disprove the fiction evolutionists like to draw in the media. Now, again, this was a picture here of Artie. They did this, you know, kind of more human slash in between with ape picture on this science magazine to make it look like this creature was a transitional. Now, here's an important point. There is nothing in the fossil record that supports species transitioning from one to another. And it's more important to actually think of kinds. See, the Bible talks about kinds. So there's a kind of cat, and there's a kind of dog. Now, in dogs and cats, there's all various types of species as this microevolution does take place in terms of traits and things like that. So when we think about nothing transitioning, it's kinds. There's nothing that goes from, like, fish to any kind of mammal. There's nothing that goes from cats to dogs. There's nothing that goes from any kind of animal, big grouping of animal, to another. There's nothing in the fossil record that supports any of that. And as part of our class, we watched a video on YouTube. You can go out and watch it. It's Evolution versus God. And they simply, this guy was asking these evolutionists, professors. He was asking these students. He was simply saying, well, where's the observable evidence for this? And just asking them questions. And it was about 30 minutes long, so it's a pretty easy watch. But it's amazing to see how he just asked them some simple, basic questions, and they sit there and they go, well, if you really aren't really observing it and there's no proof of this, wouldn't you call that faith? Yes. I mean, you ask them questions, the right questions, and they're forced to actually acknowledge that what they believe, what their professors are teaching them in class, what the professors even admit to, is that what they are actually following is a faith, and not actually supported by observable evidence, because there is nothing in the fossil record that supports it. The Java man in 1891, fossilized teeth and skull, a thigh bone, claimed to be the link. All right, here we got another one. I mean, so this is back in the 1800s. All right, so later proved to be a separate human and monkey remains together. All right, so they just died close together, or somebody buried, maybe it was a pet monkey, and they buried them together, much like people do today. All right, so they were like, here's the proof, but you know, we tested it. We have science, and we know it's actually two different creatures that were buried together. So the Hobbit man, this one was very interesting. Bones in Indonesia claimed to be the ancestor. Here we go. And of course, right there on the right side, you see that picture. All right, this is what it looks like, this transitional creature. We've got this on the science magazines. This is it. Well, guess what? It proved to be modern human remains of someone with Down syndrome. All right, so they'll find these things. They'll come up with this. All right, here's our proof. And they'll just blast it out there. They'll make, you creationists, you people who believe in God, you're just ignorant. You're stupid because, well, this is science. Well, when science actually does what science is supposed to do, we prove that, yep, this is just a human who had Down syndrome. Now, DNA is a language. And it's a code that tells us what to do. A book requires an author. The book must be in the right language for the reader. And the God is the author of the code. So you break down, you stretch out DNA, has what we call these base pairs, A, T, G, C, U, A, C, D. I mean, it's a code. It's literally a code that we have actually cracked. All right? So the DNA from one of your cells would be impossible, would be 6 feet long if you uncoiled each strand and placed them at the end. To do this for all your DNA and the resulting strand would be 67 billion miles long, the same as about 150,000 trips to the moon. That's a lot of coding. All right, so 3.2 billion, that's how many base pairs, sets of genetic letters make up the human genome. In order to list all those letters, a person would have to type 60 words a minute, 8 hours a day for about 50 years. So you take that genome just in one of our strands, the 26 chromosomes, it would take you that long to type it all out. Now, humans are by no means the species with the most base pairs. A marble lungfish has about 133 billion of them in its genome. Now, why would a simpler creature evolve to have like such a complex genome? Well, it doesn't make any sense because God created it that way. We don't know exactly why. The human DNA is nearly 5% different than chimpanzees. Which, when you break that down, that's about 150 million different base pairs than the closest chimp. Now, evolutionists claim this is evidence for evolution. Chimps are our distant cousin, as they say. So they'll say 5%. Ooh, that's so close. Now, most humans, between all of our different traits, I mean, we have different skin colors, hair colors, eye color. I mean, there's just a lot of different traits we have. That's only 0.4 difference in the human species amongst our DNA. But they'll say 5%. That must mean we are related. Well, 150 million base pairs. Each one of those codes is different. So that would have to be 150 million perfect accidents over the last 2 million years. They say it's been about 2 million years ago that we've evolved from this ancient ancestor ape. But that would take 150 million mutations, essentially, and perfect mutations to get from what that ancient ancestor would be to what we see today. So if I was to pay you for 1 cent for each difference, you'd walk out of here with $1.5 million in your pocket. So evolutionists have been desperate for a long time to have people not believe in God. I mean, they've been doing it. They'll come up with evidence and they'll say, this is, oh, looky here, this is, there's no God, this is how it is. And usually they're disproven. Now, if the church agrees with evolution, there's some things here that come into play. And I'm thinking of a Facebook post that I did after the Is Genesis History came out. I said, yeah, here it is. God created things in 6 days. And one of my college friends, she said, well, you know, I really don't agree with you. But we all serve the same God. Love your brother. We all serve the same God. You know, give you a big hug. Well, I disagree with that. Because the God that she would choose to serve is writing untruths in the Bible. So if we agree with evolution, we give in to this mindset, we're calling what God wrote in his word, and Jesus essentially a liar. We're saying that death and destruction were present from the beginning and not a perfect world that God made. He made everything perfect. He walked in the cool garden with Adam and Eve. They would never die until they sinned and everything changed in creation. The Bible and the gospel become a myth and a fictional story. There's no hope of eternal salvation. There's no purpose or reason for morality. We give in to evolution and things break down. So God created man in his own image. In the image of God, he created him. Male and female, he created them. Now, faith is the assurance of things hoped for, the conviction of things not seen, for by it the people of old received their commendation. By faith, we understand that the universe was created by the word of God, so that what is seen was not made out of things that are visible. In your hearts, honor Christ as Lord is holy, always being prepared to make a defense to anyone who asks you for a reason for the hope that is in you. Yet do it with gentleness and respect. I mean, go out and watch that video of evolution versus God, because you'll see he doesn't get threatening. He doesn't attack them. He doesn't make fun of them. These are very smart people, very educated. Again, they're smarter than me from a school standpoint. They just simply ask them questions. And of course, through this, we can defend God's creation with reason and logic. We can confess Jesus as Lord of all creation and share his gospel with a lost world. And that's what it boils down to. They don't want to believe in a God. They want to believe in what they own. They want to have as their own morality. What they want to do in the way they want to do it. But God offers us eternal salvation, a God that created us, a God that created us perfect. We sinned, and he is making it right. Jesus is restoring us. So the gospel is that while we were sinners, Christ died for us. He died and he rose again for our sins. And we obey the gospel by believing in him, by responding through faith and being baptized into his name and rising to walk as a new creature. And that is the good news that comes out of defending our faith. And so if you've not had the chance to obey the gospel today, why not today? Or if you are a Christian and you've struggled with this, or you have any needs that you need to bring before the church, you can come now, or any of our wonderful elders who will listen to you after service. If you have any needs, please come as we stand and as we sing.